of July 21st, 2013, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 199, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news-making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
In Cape Town, I'm Michael Giltz.
I suppose we will figure out what Cape Town is during the show.
That's right, because who's our first guest?
Well, on today's show, we'll be joined by Jeff Boucher, actually, from Entertainment Weekly, for our annual post-Comic-Con visit. And he's going to, of course, tell us what films and TV shows made big splashes at Comic-Con this year. So I'm looking forward to it. We've talked to him, I think, every year.
That's right. He's our Comic-Con expert.
That's right. Well, of course, he's from Entertainment Weekly. Now, before we get going on today's show, I should mention that next week we will not be having a show. And I believe that's the week of July 20, 30, I don't know, July 30th, I think. No.
I believe that's the week of Sperling Weaseling Out. It's July 29th.
Thank you.
July 28th, the week of July 28th.
None of us know the date next week, but next week there will not be a show. But we still urge you to...
Because you're traveling.
Because I'm traveling, yes.
I'm available. And I'm traveling, in fact, on the 31st through the 13th. I'll be down south in Birmingham, Alabama. Come by and say hello, everybody. But I'll still be doing the show.
Birmingham, Alabama. You know, you'll come by, try the veal. You're in town all 2 weeks.
That's right.
Exactly. We still urge everyone, of course, to subscribe to the show in iTunes or in Stitcher or wherever they give podcasts away for free, all those podcast aggregators. And please do rate and review the show on those podcast aggregators. It does help us out. Of course, you can follow us on Twitter, where our username is at Showbiz Sandbox, or you can like us on Facebook. You can find us under Showbiz Sandbox, facebook.com/Showbiz Sandbox. Or you can email us your comments. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Or even call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. And all of that information can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com.
Now, so since they missed the show next week, I guess this week will be extra packed with information. So what else is there other than Jeff Boucher? Not that he isn't enough.
Well, we'll also be going over some of the nominations announced last week for the Netflix Awards. This year's Emmy Awards for television. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines, and we'll close with some inside baseball. But first, as always, we turn it over to you, Michael, entertainment journalist extraordinaire. You're going to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right. We're talking about the weekend box office around the world, because we don't just focus on North America, because they make most of their money overseas, and that's, we follow the money. Go where the money is. That's why you rob banks. Anyway, the number one movie world.
You're robbing banks?
The number one movie around the world is Despicable Me 2. Yet again, it grossed $60 million worldwide. It's at $584 million and counting. It's passed up Monsters University, which is doing darn well itself, but it is a monster hit and still going strong. At number two around the world is Pacific Rim, a movie that needs to make a lot of money in the Pacific Rim for it to hit profitability. It grossed another $50 million. It's at $178 million and counting. It's playing in 49 territories, so it's playing pretty wide. But, you know, it cost $190 million to make, so it needs to get a lot more money in the bank before that movie can be moved out of the red column. At number three is one of the big success stories of the year, at least in North America. It's a horror film. It opened up at number one here. It's called The Conjuring. It stars Vera Farmiga, and it grossed $44.9 million. Basically, all of that in North America, just a little bit of it overseas, about $3 million overseas. So this is a low-budget horror film, got very good reviews, especially for a horror film, of course. I'm putting that in context. And it doubled its budget on opening weekend. Cost $20 million to make. It grossed $44 million on opening weekend. That's a success story that Hollywood loves.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think everybody was talking about how The Conjuring is it's the new way to make movies in Hollywood.
Ridiculous.
I read three or four stories about that, and I thought, really? You must be groping for news to write if that's your story.
Well, another movie that's sort of questionable is Turbo. This is from DreamWorks Animation, correct?
Yes.
It grossed $44 million. In North America over the weekend. It's at $53 million total. There's also some international money mixed in there. So it's from Fox. They're the distributor. It's in 29 territories. So it's just starting to really open up a little bit overseas. $53 million. It cost like $130 million to make. And everybody said, hey, look at Despicable Me 2. That only cost $76 million. Why did this movie cost so much? Can you make animated films? You know, they're very expensive to make. $130 million is not a lot of money for an animated film. And as we have detailed at length, DreamWorks Animation has had lots of great success stories over the past 10, 15 years with their animated films. But since Turbo is a flop, I guess they'll be hiring more people. I guess that's what they do at DreamWorks Animation. If it's a big hit, they fire you. If it's a flop, I guess they'll bring in more people. Of course, we don't know if it's a flop yet, but because it did get pretty good audience responses. It's at 53 million worldwide. We'll have to see how it does at the end, but not a great start.
Everybody I know who saw the trailer,
yeah,
all adults, of course, looked at that movie and said, oh, why would I want to see that movie? Looks so bad. It looked bad at Comic-Con. It looked bad before Comic-Con. The posters didn't make me want to see it. The trailers didn't make me want to see it. And then I think everybody felt the same way. Then the week of release, all these critics were saying, hey, actually, it shouldn't be a good movie. It shouldn't be enjoyable to watch, but it kind of is.
I wouldn't say the reviews were sterling or terribly strong.
No,
they were, you know, polite.
Yes.
I think was the best it got, I think. Nobody said this is a delightful gem. It does have a high quotient of Latino voice actors. And so it is possible that it could play well in Central and South America, Mexico, in Latin American countries like Spain, going overseas to Europe. So, you know, that could be a good draw for the movie for people who don't get to hear themselves represented on animated films a lot, except in secondary comic roles.
Well,
so
except for the fact
might that be something that might be something that will appeal to that movie and have better legs overseas than you might expect.
Legs, get it? Because it's a snail? Get it? It's about a snail.
I wasn't making a joke.
Well, you know, the thing is, Michael, they actually dub all those movies in Latin American, well, almost all countries, because they're for children.
Well, I'm assuming that, but they're Latin characters, and I assume that the Latin or Hispanic, but I assume the actors doing them probably speak Spanish and will be doing the dubbing.
Okay.
I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but I think they consciously made a choice. The many characters that would appeal to the Latino and Hispanic audience, and they're not going to lose that when they go to Central and South America. Those stars will still be represented. Of course, all the voices will be in Spanish, but nonetheless, right. They know the difference between looking at Henry Cavill and Superman or Man of Steel and, you know, an actual actor who is Spanish or Latino. I've really messed up the ethnic descriptions there. But anyway, you're going to get my point. At number five around the world is Red 2. This is a sequel to Red, a sort of unexpected hit about middle-aged or older, mature artists getting in an action flick. Helen Mirren's in the mix. Patrick Stewart. Who else is in that movie? John Malkovich. You know, it's a sort of an action. Anthony Hopkins.
Yes.
Sort of an action film. It grossed $26 million. It is opened up in a few territories overseas.
12, yeah.
In North America, it opened at number 5. So, you know, well below even Grown Ups 2, the second weekend of Grown Ups 2, which fell by over 50%, which frankly is not as hard as I thought it would fall. At number 6 is Monsters University, the Pixar film that we already talked about, another $25 million worldwide. At number 7 is the Adam Sandler film, Grown Ups 2, another $25 million. It's at $88 million and counting. Didn't cost a lot to make. It's just past its budget, but it's going to take, you know, need to double that before they start to get into the black. At number 8, another big flop. We talk about Turbo as being questionable. We talk about Pacific Rim as, hey, let's wait to see how it does overseas. Maybe it won't be the total disaster, you know, that it might appear to be. Ripped, RIPD, Rest in Peace Department, opened at $19 million, and this looks like another big flop. It cost $130 million to make based on a comic book. It opened very poorly in North America at number 7. People hated it. They ran in the other direction. The reviews were horrible. And the New York Times, following up on our story, did their own article about how, look at all these summer flops and look what Spielberg said. And is this going to change Hollywood? They spoke to studio executives and everybody said, yeah, no, not really.
Let me think about that. No, it's not going
to. You're
going to
roll up your sleeves and get back to work. You have a flop. Everybody has flops. Are there more flops this summer than usual? Are they more expensive in comparison to what movies cost? I think it's just that the price of making movies has gone up. So you see a movie, it costs $130 million. You think, oh my God. And it flops. You think, oh my God, it's a disaster. Well, but movies just, they don't make a lot of movies for less than $100 million. Not when you're talking big summer film, right?
Well, right. And it's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy in a way, because all of these studios are, you know, they started making these big, giant blockbusters, these big, giant tentpoles.
Well, didn't they always?
Yes, but now, I mean, and they're effects laden, and now people want everything to go above and beyond. Well, if you spend $100 million...
They always tried to top themselves. In the 70s, movies cost more than they did in the 60s. In the 80s, they cost more than the 70s. This is not anything, it's just inflation.
Right.
They're not suddenly gambling $1 trillion on every movie. It's just movies cost more to make.
Right.
Right. So are there an extraordinary number of flops this summer? Are they of an extraordinarily high budget cost compared to movies in general? I don't think so.
Yeah, I actually would wonder if there are more flops this year or more blockbuster box office disappointments than there were last year. But because
One year, that's just a tiny sample. But I think overall, it doesn't seem like a bizarre, unusual amount of summer. And when you look at some of the movies that look like flops, like World War Z looks like it'll pull its bacon out of the fire. Lone Ranger is clearly a disaster financially. Pacific Rim, it may end up with $300, $350 million. So, it's not going to make money, but it's not going to be a black hole of financial loss.
No, I think that though with Pacific Rim, The Lone Ranger, they're looking for franchise starters, and neither of those films.
Oh, okay. So now you're saying, well, they failed to launch a wildly successful multi-film franchise.
Right.
That's not the same as saying there have been such disastrous flops of such high proportions that Hollywood is going to change the way it does business.
Well, I guess the question is, will they really shoot for the stars with these franchise starters, or will they just...
Of course!
Yeah, I mean, I think that somebody was
saying... Well, I don't think they shot for the stars with Ripped. It cost $130 million.
Right.
But, I mean, it starred Jeff Bridges and whatever. It's not exactly, a $220 million massive roll of the dice.
Right, and that I agree with. Okay, so you spent $130 million on a film, hoping that it would be a franchise starter, and it wasn't. Okay,
right.
Fine. You didn't spend $300. You should be happy that you didn't spend $300 million trying to launch a franchise and then see it just completely collapse.
And you can't consciously spend $40 million to try and launch a big summer blockbuster franchise. You can get Lucky. You can get Paranormal Activity.
Right.
You can get Saw. You can get Nerds, Revenge of the Nerds. But those are just lucky little things. When you set out to make a big movie, it's going to cost you money.
That's right.
Well, that's what happened with World War Z. They set out to make a big movie. This weekend, it grossed $17 million. It's at $450 million worldwide and counting. Cost a lot to make, but it's making a fair amount of money. So it's not going to, it's $190 million. So it's just getting into the black. So let's not pop open the champagne cork. But nonetheless, they're not going to lose their shirt. The talk of a sequel to me is crazy. What's the point? And, they should be just thrilled that they didn't lose a lot of money. But that's Hollywood for
you. I mean, what did they do? They destroyed the world in the first one. This one will destroy the galaxy.
Exactly. Do you think the zombies are dead? And then there they come back again.
Just like zombies.
At number 10, The Lone Ranger, which we've talked about, another $16 million. It's falling hard and fast all over the world. People overseas are not enamored with Westerns, the way I am, at least. And made $147 million worldwide and counting. And there's not a lot left to count. At number 11, The Heat, the Sandra Bullock, Melissa McCarthy comedy, another $14 million. It's at $150 million and counting. $25 million of that comes from overseas. Maybe Melissa McCarthy will start to spread her domination of comedy to the world now that she is such a big star in North America. And at number 12, like I've said before, the sort of movie I love to see succeed, it's Now You See Me. A mid-budget film geared towards adults costs $75 million to make. It's about to triple that budget. It's at $200 million worldwide and counting. So a solid success story. Let's hope they don't make a sequel.
Now, it's a success story, and yet, for some reason, I can't recall what this movie is about and who
it's
is in it.
It's the magicians who rob banks and give the money to the poor.
Oh, my gosh, that's
or some
right.
Such thing.
That is right. I had counted that movie out so long ago that, okay.
I don't know why. At number 13, the Will Smith flop After Earth. That's at $235 million and counting. At number 14, the success story, Man of Steel. Big budget, young star that nobody really knew. Get roll of the dice. Huge budget. What was it, $220, $230? Is that what it cost?
Something like that. Yeah.
Right. It's grossed $636 million and counting. At number 15, another flop, White House Down. That's at $92 million worldwide and counting. And at number 16 is Cold Eyes. That's at $27 million and counting. I wonder if and when it will come to North America. That's all from one territory for that flick.
Wow. What territory?
The Cold Eyes is the is that the Hong Kong film?
Aha,
which one?
I finally
is it North Korea? South Korea?
I caught you.
which country is it from?
I don't know.
Oh, you don't know? Oh, it's we've covered.
That's
it last
why
week.
I was asking.
I forgot to write down in my notes which film that was, because it hasn't opened up here. So the only way we know about it is talking about it here on Showbiz Sandbox. I forgot to carry over my notes from last week. And there's a couple other films that opened up around the world, including Foosball. Some film was called Foosball. And I don't know what country that opened in or what it's about, but it made a couple $1 million. Cold Eyes is the South Korean action film. So it's in one territory and it's made $27 million so far. So good for them.
Now, you know, you were asking about RIPD and how it's such a flop and whether there are more flops this year than last year. Turbo, I thought for sure would just, I don't know, fall off a cliff and gather up all the critics, and they would just lambast the movie. And indeed, that it did not happen. However, at least once per year, there is a movie in which all the critics kind of, they sharpen their pencils and they all try to write the, and they don't do this kind of in
I thought this was collusion. Lone Ranger. I thought Lone Ranger got incredibly brutal reviews.
Right.
Where they were sarcastic and obnoxious. But you're going to say that Ripped is the one that did it this year.
Right, exactly. The LA Times had a story where they said, "Up, everybody sharpened the pencils," and they tried to write their little quips, their memorable little quips, for RIPD.
Well, I guess when you get so, you have such a miserable time at the box office that you sort of want to get some revenge somehow.
Right. I guess, I thought what was interesting, okay, you have Larry McLeagle over at film.com. He calls it a movie-like substance.
I've never heard of that. Film.com?
Oh, yeah. No, they're pretty big, actually.
Oh, you say that about every website. You're just a web whore.
I'm a web whore. You know what? Title. I'm a web whore, and how
you
I
are.
Got there.
I mean, the New York Post, that's an outlet I've heard of.
Yeah, you used to write for them.
I did, yeah.
And, what did he say? The plot manages to be fully predictable and freakishly bonkers at the same time, seemingly born of the same kind of brainstorming on LSD session that must have given us Howard the Duck.
Richard Corliss of Time Magazine said he was reading from his notes that he took in the screening room, and he wrote, "A half hour into the film, and it feels like the eighth day of jury duty."
Yeah, but you know what? He actually said the same thing that I thought the moment that I first saw footage from this film. I thought, Jeff Bridges really has to either fix the speech
impediment. Stop doing this shtick.
Yes. And he wrote, he should think about mothballing the quote-unquote coot character he played in Men Who Stare at Goats, Crazy Heart, and True Grit. The varmint swagger and intonation steeped in tobacco juice were fine once or twice, but outsize is not the right size for a performer long acclaimed for his range and subtlety. I could not agree more. I couldn't understand him. In the trailers and in the footage I saw, I thought, well, maybe it's not done. Maybe they'll make his dialogue more distinguishable. I could not understand him. And I thought, is he continuing to act that way for a reason? Does he have
he's in crappy movies and he just wants to just ignore the fact?
I don't know. I thought maybe he's got a speech impediment as he grows older. I don't know.
Well, same thing in Seventh Son. This is a fantasy film that comes out this year. He plays a mentor to our young fantasy hero. And it sounds like he has marbles in his mouth. I mean, I saw the trailer in front of Pacific Rim. You couldn't understand a word he said. It was like a joke.
Yeah, well, you know, I know as I grow older, as listeners of Showbiz Sandbox probably know, I grow my own speech impediment, so.
Well, so terrible reviews. Grown Ups 2 has even lower rating at RottenTomatoes.com, but at 11%, Ripped is certainly one of the worst reviewed movies of the year. Then anybody who paid to see it probably felt chipped, especially because it cost them more.
That's right. Patrick Corcoran, who we've had here on the show in the past, he is the vice president and chief communications officer over at the National Association of Theater Owners. He sent us an email last week saying, hey, Q2 prices, ticket prices, of course, these are averages for the North American, for North America, $8.38 average ticket price. The first half average was $8.16. And a lot of folks, the industry is not faulting, but pointing to 3D and IMAX films. The tickets prices.
Well, the industry is not faulting it. They're thrilled. They like it when ticket prices rise, as long as people keep going to the movies.
Right.
But was attendance up?
I don't know.
There you go. If prices are up and attendance is down, that's not a good trend.
Right. I guess the average price increased 5.5% from $7.94 in the first quarter.
My numbers. Tickets cost more because people are going to see 3D and IMAX films. And what were the big movies in the first half? Star Trek Into Darkness, Iron Man 3. Those are what are driving the ticket prices up. You have a $1.5 billion movie. Guess what? A lot of people are going to pay up to see that movie in IMAX and 3D.
So let me get this straight, okay? So these big franchise tentpole movies that come from big giant studios with giant catalogs attract customers and money. And sometimes smaller films,
like our big hit this week, The Conjuring.
The Conjuring, right? They may have unrecognizable names.
Wow, Vera Farmiga.
Okay.
An Oscar-nominated actress, I believe.
You'll see where I'm going with this. They may have new talent, new filmmakers, new storylines. They may not attract people as much, and may not be from such big studios and with big catalogs. Hold on to that thought for the end of the show.
All right.
See, I'm teasing. You see how I did that? I'm teasing.
So opening up this week is another big movie with a big star and big money. It's Wolverine starring Hugh Jackman, along with the new Woody Allen film, Blue Jasmine, which got some pretty good reviews, which is a nice change of pace for Woody, and a teen comedy called The To-Do List. But, of course, the big one is Wolverine. It's tracking at about $70 million. That's what they think it will open to this weekend, which would make it a big movie. I wonder how the fans at Comic-Con, whether they're excited by this movie, whether they feel like this is finally going to be the really good Wolverine film that they've been waiting for. Who could answer that question for us?
Hugh Jackman.
Well, yes, Hugh Jackman's not on the phone, but Jeff Boucher is.
That is true. In fact, Jeff Boucher, who when we last spoke with him was working or transitioning from the Los Angeles Times to where he now resides at Entertainment Weekly, he is the king of comic books, or at least the king of knowledge of comic books.
That's true. He is the king of pop culture, too, not just comic books,
That's
but
true.
Movies and TV shows. A lot of stuff fanboy related, but his portfolio is, I'm sure, has grown even larger now that he's at Entertainment Weekly, and he's launched the online presence there called Cape Town, which does what he did at the LA Times so well. So he's here to talk to us about Comic-Con and how he's doing at Entertainment Weekly and launching a new online presence and whether fans are excited for Hugh Jackman and Wolverine.
Jeff, thank you for joining us.
It is great to be here. How are you guys doing?
Terrific. How are you? You must be exhausted from a weekend of Comic-Con, or is it a little easier now? You've done it times, maybe you're an old pro, and it's not quite so exhausting like in years gone past.
Well, it's more exhausting for me because I am old and creaky and decrepit, but I've never been part of a team this big before.
It sounded like there were 20 reporters from EW there. How many people were there?
I have no idea. I mean, it was more than that, because if you count all the editors that come in and they do the photo shoot and they do the EW and then the party, they plan the party and everything. It's like everybody's there. It's actually, I got to meet a lot of people from New York that I hadn't met before.
Well, now, is this just for the website, or does it also go into the magazine? I would imagine it's both. You can mine it for everything it's worth.
Of course, yeah. And of course, there's a lot of ramp-up coverage. We had our EW Comic-Con preview issue, which is traditional, and then this year we did something new, and it was a magazine that was just available on site, an EW Comic-Con edition that was different, had some of the same names and stories and subjects, but they were all standalone and unique stories, so they weren't just regurgitated. And that's new, and that was a free on-site thing, and I hope a tradition.
Well, that's cool. So there's still stories being printed and written. It seemed like my impression from the outside was that for a lot of outlets, including EW, they all had their little area where they were videotaping. It seemed like half the stories were just introductions to videos.
Yeah, not. Speaking for corporate culture, but just as far as, corporate standpoint on this, but just as a interested observer of the whole sphere, sector, I think what it is that, this audience for this material is so eager to click. So it's low-hanging fruit every year. Everybody wants all that internet traffic, and you just can't write it as fast as you can do video. And then also a lot of tradigital media are finding that are finding that advertisers are eager or more amenable to buying ads that go up against video a la a TV commercial, because they can see it and it has more charisma to them than a pop-up window and potentially more effectiveness.
Well, now the New York Times, they had an article that tried to argue that fans of Comic-Con were not getting all hot and bothered the way they used to by Hollywood showing up Hollywood has kind of gone there and had a bigger presence there over the years, that their presence has grown. and that they preferred offbeat and funky stuff. And then the very next day, the New York Times followed that with a story about how all the big Hollywood movies that played at Comic-Con and which ones got good reactions.
Hall H.
Yeah, Hall H. Oh, you should see all the people. So what is true? Is Comic-Con done with Hollywood?
No, but it's like, are they a little more smart and jaded? They're not excited just because Hollywood shows up. Now they're a little more discerning. You got to have something where you care about and are excited about and do a good job with it.
I'm not even sure that's true because, you know, I think that's true. Like the blogger community and the sort of those people, you know, that are now, you know, 12 years into, you know, writing about Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and Dwayne Johnson's body of work as just like myself. they may be getting a little more jaded, but I mean, to me, Comic-Con, they go nuts. They go nuts. I don't see anything different. I mean, they may recognize shoddy work faster because they've, you know, watched a lot of DVD extras and they, you know, they are used to watching special effects early on and they know who, you know, who's doing the, you know, the makeup on Walking Dead and who the fact that Lucasfilm did their first animation on Rango and things like, I mean, they know more, so you can't just, you know, kind of do nothing. But as far as just enthusiasm or as far as, you know, sort of emotional connection, I detect no sense of new sophistication or distance from the subject matter. These people, and I count myself as one of them, just go there to scream and yell and have fun. I mean, I moderated a panel for Fox for X-Men Days of Future Past, and it was
nerdvana
in that room. it was nerdgasm. It was like ridiculous. Like people lost their minds. It was there was a woman like almost weeping at the microphone, saying it was the best night of her life. And Peter Dinklage looked at me like, oh my God, like it was pretty funny. Like it was not visible to the audience, but he was, I think hoping that she would have a better night sometime soon.
Well, so how was it overall? The attendance, the stuff is just another strong year. How did you feel overall about it as far as the quality of the presentations and the fans and the diversity of material on display? Does it feel like there's a little comeback for books and publishing comics, or it's just more and more Hollywood and TV every year?
Well, that's a good question. I it's hard to say because I think what's happened in comics specifically is that you're just getting pushed more and more toward just these massive events in comics and that you're, you know, and, you know, more number one issues and more, you know, sort of things that tie together the entire mythologies and stuff like that, or kill people off and bring them back. I mean, that seems to be the, you know, the list of way to do the list of, you know, preferred tactics and stuff like that. And I don't know.
I may do that with Sperling.
Yes. He keeps threatening.
Yeah. I mean, he kind of looks like Bucky, you know, I mean, might not. I think, you know, I can't tell what's going on in comics. I think it's sort of interesting that IDW has moved up and is now, I believe, third or fourth in market share.
And this is Image Comics, right?
No, IDW down in San Diego. They moved past Dark Horse.
They're third.
Like the last 5 months. So yeah, they're probably fourth, right behind. I mean, obviously Marvel, DC, and then I was trying to think if Image was ahead of them, but probably is. But, you know, I don't know enough about what's going on with each individual shop, but, you know, I it seems like everybody's trying to make sure that the IP keeps coming from comics, and they sort of hold on to the paper brochures as a ritual. You know, I don't know that digital comics has really found its feet yet. I don't know that there's a final answer there, or there may be, and I just haven't seen it yet, which is very possible.
Well, when you see the types of movies that Hollywood makes, you know, that IP, that those stories and those comic book stories, they really need to keep coming because otherwise Hollywood won't have any movies to make. I know that in years past, Hollywood has, you know, they fared okay, I guess, at Comic-Con, but they've also been burned. How did Hollywood do this year?
I think Hollywood did well, but you know, it's funny on the IP thing, jumping back to that for a second, my reflexive response would be to agree with you. But then if you think about it, I mean, look at the stuff that's getting made. I mean, Lone Ranger was created in 1933, Superman, 1938, Batman, 1939, John Carter and Mars, 1912. They're making a Tarzan movie, 1912. Captain America, 1941 or 1940. Thor's probably 63. You don't see a lot of new things getting made. Red, R-E-D would be one.
Yeah,
This month.
Ripped, R-I-P-D, yeah.
Yeah, R-I-P-D. Living up to that title. You had Dark Horse was doing a lot of stuff, a lot of movies like, Hellboy and The Mask before that, and then 300. But then you've seen them sort of hit a dry spell, and most of the stuff that's getting made is based on characters that are much, much, much older. I mean, the only character the last 40 years other that's really having a renaissance, in film right now. I mean, it's obviously Wolverine, is from the early 70s, and Men in Black. Men in Black, I thought that third movie was pretty good. But the rest, it's kind of hard to find someone that's really making a foothold.
First of all, thank you and the EW team for doing all that coverage, because I didn't need to go. I could just sit at home and watch everything that was going on at Comic-Con. The coverage this year was endless, but the big news seemed to be
unbelievable.
Yeah. I mean, the big news seemed to be Batman and Superman, Warner Brothers announcing this mashup, if you will. And Ann Thompson over at IndieWire saying, hey, this is a bad idea that there are movies that are just not ever going to work with audiences, where the degree of difficulty is too high or the potential for getting it wrong too great. Do you agree with that? And what was the response to this announcement?
The response was, woohoo!
The response was damp. it was a very strong response. I actually ran into Anne at the EW party, and she told me her kind of gave me a preview of that column. I just totally disagree. I just don't know. I don't know what makes that movie any more difficult to pull off than Captain America and Bucky and the Falcon and Black Widow teaming up in this next Captain America movie. I think if anything, the biggest problem in Metropolis, the biggest problem with Superman movies is the lack of great villains. I think,
right.
We've seen, Lex Luthor like again and again and again. We've seen Zod twice, and he was a minor character in the comics. I mean, he was not a major character until he started spinning across the screen in the glass, plane at the beginning of Superman. So I think putting him in Gotham City makes him interesting. I think it brings out the anti-authority stuff in Batman. I think it has this sort of classic dichotomy between the control freak and the guy that is kind of almost a
Boy Scout.
I was gonna say jingoist, but that sounds so negative. He's a patriot. You kind of get what you have between. A little bit between if you had Wolverine and Captain America on the screen together, which would probably be a pretty successful film. So I don't know why. I don't think it's inherently wrong to do that. I don't think it's bad. I mean, they've been making comic books together since 1939. World's Fair, World's Finest. I think the first issue was called World's Fair Comics, 1939. It doesn't seem like overly mercenary to me or inherently ungainly.
Once something that the fans seem to genuinely agree on, and they agree with the filmmakers, is 3D. The fans don't like it, and now the filmmakers are saying, you know what, we don't like it either. Did you hear any backlash against 3D this year?
you know, there was the loudest backlash of all, which is, I mean, how many studio presentations were there in Hall H this year? You know, I don't know the number, but everybody was around. And I think Fox was the only one that did 3D for the whole weekend. I mean,
wow.
I'm probably wrong about that. I wasn't in there the whole weekend, but they told me that they were the only, they thought they were the only ones. So you might want to double check that. But my sense is that if there was another, it was a fairly short list.
Yeah, I guess there was a panel where Edgar Wright, the filmmaker behind Shaun of the Dead, and Alfonso Cuarón, who just made a 3D film, he just made a 3D film, and he says, "I hate 3D. That the resolution is horrible, and the blacks and whites are dampened down. He doesn't like it." Mark Webb, who shot a film, The Amazing Spider-Man, and now that was shot in 3D. Now he's post-converting the second Spider-Man. He hates 3D.
Oh, you know, it's funny because you see these weird things start to happen. The generation above those guys are constantly talking about how caught up they are in it. I mean, you know, Ridley Scott says he'll never make another movie that's not 3D. You know, Michael Bay was one of the loudest, you know, voices against 3D. Now he's, you know, in love with it. And, you know, I mean, obviously Ang Lee, Martin Scorsese. And, it's interesting that you're getting this, you know, polarized result and that they're going in different directions.
I wonder if it has to do with the budgets, like, you know, Ridley Scott and Spielberg and all these guys, they get big budgets, so they don't have to worry so much. Whereas like Edgar Wright, he's in the budget where he can't do everything he wants, and he has to be more hands-on with it, and it's become more of a hurdle than anything else.
I think it's an aging veteran who finds suddenly 3D creates a new sort of challenge, and they feel like they're creatively excited again, even though it doesn't really add anything to the movie. To them, it sort of wakes them up a bit, and maybe they kid themselves that, oh, this is, you know, here I am, I'm on the cutting edge. Whereas younger filmmakers just say, hey, it's really hard to show them properly. You can't control how well they're done in theaters. The pain in the neck to shoot, it adds very little. I can't remember the last review I read that said, oh, the 3D is really good. So, but that's my feeling. But Jeff, you were there at the place. One of the great previous stories you did was an interview with Alan Moore, the creator of Sandman, among many other things, including The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. It was a very fun interview. We'll link to it in the show notes. Was that your best geeky moment leading up to Comic-Con? And what was your favorite classic fanboy moment that you had as far as, you know, something that you did for yourself?
You know what? I went, I bought some stuff, much to my wife's chagrin, but not, it's not as bad as last year when I bought a Kirby piece of original art for the first time.
Ooh.
But this year I got a 1978 Spider-Man calendar that was like practically unopened, and I immediately opened it, and I'm hoping to return to that year because it was really, you know, the last good year. I think of anything. And then I also bought a Star Wars Darth Vader TIE Fighter, the one with the curved wings.
Ooh.
From 1977 in the box with the stickers.
Nice.
And everything and the instructions. And so it's you can see that I'm sort of, you know, maturing backwards again. It's, you know, so it's not going well here as far as being a fanboy. I'm just surrounding myself with toys and calendars from the, you know, Carter administration.
Well, that sounds like a horrible job. And when we last spoke with you, you were actually transitioning from the LA Times to your new job. So have there been any big surprises at the new job at Entertainment Weekly?
You know, sure, yeah, tons of surprises but everything is great, and I love, we had this great film festival, because you guys know I love doing live events, and it's really been a big part of the success that I've had with online stuff, and we had this great film festival we showed Escape from New York with Kurt Russell, and Star Trek with Leonard Nimoy, and we had John Carpenter and Edgar Wright and Mark Hamill and Terry Gilliam and Neil Gaiman. So it was a fantastic, five, 6 days, and that was thanks to EW, and there's big things ahead, so it's been tremendous, and my wife still works at the LA Times, and I still read Hero Complex. I just don't
So you've launched Cape Town. That's the home for what you do at EW, as well as a lot of other areas on the magazine, of course, including cover stories. Any surprising challenges in relaunching a new online presence, building on what you did at the LA Times with Hero Complex?
Yeah.
Anything that sort of surprised you?
Yeah, with Cape Town, trying to fill in, you're exactly right. I mean, there's always some setbacks and unexpected things, and it's just different. Everything's different. And working with, I've never worked with such a vigorous report. And I found I think it's been hard for me to kind of put my stamp on the site because of it, you know, because I can't, at Hero Complex, I was in charge of everything that went on that page. And I think sometimes, you know, the difference between good and great is what you don't do. Like, I never did a casting rumor post on Hero Complex ever, not even one. I just thought it was like a waste of time and credibility and resources. Here the staff is in New York, and it's a vigorous, vibrant, kind of, you know, ready to go army. And, you know, I haven't even met most of them, so you know, I kind of created the playground, but it's not my direct curation anymore. But that's what I have the live events and of course my own byline for.
Well, I noticed you had the a photo slideshow like everybody does, the costume women of Comic-Con. You can see where I'm going with this about what's missing. You're the costume women of Comic-Con day one, day two. I'm like, hello.
Where are the costume men?
Exactly.
Okay. That's I was just,
you know, I tried to put up 65 photos of me in various costumes, Michael, and they just would not they would not go for it. They said it was alarming. They made me go to the doctor again. No, I'm just joking. You know what? I think you're right. I think I'd like to see both. I'd like to see us do neither of those, quite honestly.
I'm with you on that. But if you're going to do it, let's have equal opportunity objectification. But I prefer you do neither as well. But that's one of the things where you have to say, well, it's not my playground anymore. So one of the things you're learning and moving forward on, I guess.
Exactly. You know, it's nothing is monolithic once you get to a certain level of people. So you're going to have this sort of competing ideas and interests on the whole though, I mean, like, as you said at the beginning of this, I mean, look at that coverage. I mean, the coverage of Comic-Con this year, I used to go down, it was me, and you know, and then I'm part of this, you know, it's like ABC covering a campaign, you know, in the presidential campaign in the 80s or something. which is just nutty. It's and wonderful and gratuitous and great. So it's just always fun to be down there. I was really excited to do a couple panels. I did Ronald Moore's panel for Helix, which they think sci-fi is very, 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 very excited about. And I read the scripts and I liked it a lot. I did Wolverine. I've seen the film all the way through. I thought it was great. I liked it a lot.
By far the best? The Wolverine movie? Yeah.
Yes, yeah, the Wolverine, the Wolverine, yes. He was Wolverine, but now he's the Wolverine.
Well, that's because Wolverine was taken by Warner Brothers in a 1916 short.
You had to come to us, like, do you have any breaking news to share with us? You had to do some reporting right before you got on the air. You suggested you might have new news to share. I don't know whether that's true or not.
Well, I have some. I thought I would have a little more out of Chris than I'd got, but I did get some fun stuff about his reaction to
who? Everybody. Tell him.
Chris Hemsworth. Thor, the mighty Thor, as you will. I just talked to him, so I'm going to be putting something up shortly on that. That has his reaction to people finding out about his severed hand in the sequel. Which is one of the things that flashed across the screen. There was a lot of cool tidbits this year, a lot of things that kind of popped up if you're really kind of a close fan. And some of it hasn't even all been put together in one piece, so maybe I'll try and do that over the next day or two. But, you know, I think the Superman-Batman thing obviously is pretty exciting. I'm excited about that. And as far as things I saw that I'm looking forward to a lot, Apes. I think I really like Rise of the Planet of Apes an awful lot.
What about Veronica Mars? There was a...
Share your conspiracy theory, Sperling.
Yes, I do have a conspiracy theory about Veronica Mars. I was a little shocked to see that 3 months after the they finished this Kickstarter campaign where they raised all these millions of dollars. They managed to not only have a trailer, but they managed to shoot the film. So somehow they shot the film that they didn't have money for 3 months ago.
You know, it makes you start to wonder about if everybody's really saying what they think and what they mean. But I can't think about things that big. I don't know what's going on with... it does seem kind of weird that does seem like a fast turnaround, but, you know, they...
But I can't imagine after a decade of trying to get a movie made that they got a green light from a studio but kept it secret so they could screw over fans and get money from them. That seems even more unlikely to me.
Yeah, but, I mean, now we're getting toward, like, you know, it's starting to sound like... Jim Baker kind of stuff, you know, like this is, they're like, you know, televangelists or something. And really, isn't that what this is about? Because I think, you know, Joss Whedon could start a new 700 Club and like just kill it. I think people would just send money in.
Hold on. Paper. Okay. Joss Whedon. This is a good idea. Any others? Just taking notes.
That must be it feels like a religious revival when they get in the room with them and get to cheer them on and talk about how excited they are about the movies. And we certainly appreciate you coming by to tell us what it was like this week at Comic-Con and your new home at Entertainment Weekly and Cape Town.
It's my pleasure, guys. And I appreciate your patience. I know I had some technical problems there. And it was a great Comic-Con, and I'd love to talk to you guys soon, especially after... you know, the next week or two, because I think we're going to break some stuff you guys will be interested in.
We look forward to it.
All right, guys. I'll talk to you later.
Well, that was good of Jeff to join us, but that's a lot of stuff that happened in the future. Now we can talk about something that's big news right now. Those are the Emmy nominations. They were just announced last week.
Yes, and I think that I joked at the head of the show that we're changing the name of the Emmys to the Netflix Awards, since that's all anybody could talk about.
You would think it was the ACE Awards, frankly, since the networks got almost shut out, it felt like, in a lot of ways. But yes, the biggest news was history was made. House of Cards, a TV show that wasn't created for TV, has been nominated for the top award in television, the best drama. The sitcom is just as big an award as far as I'm concerned, but drama sometimes always has more prestige than comedy. Don't ask me why. But House of Cards, ton of nominations for this movie, miniseries, I should say.
It's a series.
It's a miniseries, really, in the UK when it was originally conceived, but then they made two more, and now it's a series, even though there's only two seasons, and then it's done. But anyway, a lot of nominations, big news, because it was, you know, they might have resisted. It took them a long time to show some Emmy love for cable. In fact, cable created their own awards, the ACE Awards. The major networks might start thinking about launching something like that again so they can still get awards, because they haven't won the best drama since 2006, when 24 was the last major network show to snag that top award.
Wow.
And now House of Cards has moved in, and it's going to be a while. You know, it's looking good. You know, Arrested Development, also on Netflix, that got some, you know, a key nomination for Best Actor. Not the same love as House of Cards, but since House of Cards got nominations, we know it wasn't because it's on Netflix. It's just they didn't like the show.
Yes, correct. And I think that, you know, you mentioned that it took a while for Emmy voters to cotton to cable. I think also the penetration of cable is greater now. I think that cable's, the fact that cable paved the way for something like Netflix to kind of make big headlines here is part of the reason.
It's still a little shocking, though. I mean, this is literally something you people can watch on a television, but it's not made to be. It's a website.
Yeah.
So like Funny or Die, why don't they get an Emmy nomination?
That's a good question. Maybe because it's not.
They are eligible.
Are they?
Programming made for websites has been eligible apparently since 2008. So this isn't the first year that something like House of Cards was eligible, but it is the first year where you've seen a really big series with big names step up to the plate and have a shot at an Emmy nomination. So while it's taken 5 years for them to break through, really it feels like at their first time at the plate, Netflix scored with this TV show. You know, Kevin Spacey, David Fincher, Robin Wright. I mean, it was high quality from start to finish. So really, if television had ignored this, they'd be biting their own hand because they're putting people to work.
Well,
actors
certainly
are acting, writers are writing, directors are directing, and they all want to make money and have business. So why ignore Netflix?
Right. And I think that's exactly right. I think they're looking at, they're embracing the future. And if they kind of had shut them out, it would say, kind of, in my opinion, it would have said, no, cable and network television, that's real TV. This Netflix stuff, it's just kind of, you know, you can do it on the side if you want.
Well, you know, here's the line I use. We've got to step back away from Netflix and look at the whole Emmy nominations process overall. What happened this year? Basically, the same stuff that happened last year. Like I've said in some interviews, people interviewed me for my opinions on what would get nominated, stuff like that. I said, well, TV viewers hate reruns, but the Emmys love them. So when you look at who's going to be nominated for best drama and best comedy, best variety show, best reality show, just look at the list from last year. And that's exactly what happened. The drama list is exactly the same as last year, but take out Boardwalk Empire and put in House of Cards. The comedy list, same as last year, but you take out Curb Your Enthusiasm and put in Louie. And guess what? Curb Your Enthusiasm wasn't even eligible this year, so they couldn't have the same list. Variety series, those are like the late night talk shows and Saturday Night Live, stuff like that. Exactly the same as last year. Reality shows, exactly the same as last year. So the Emmy nominations showed a little forward thinking by nominating House of Cards from Netflix, but frankly, they're always in a rut. You know, they always repeat themselves again and again and again. So some people say, well, there's just an embarrassment of riches. Tim Goodman of The Hollywood Reporter says, should the Emmys expand to 10 nominations in major categories? Because every year we talk about all these shows that are out of the loop, and maybe they just need to expand it like the Oscars did. What do you say to that, Sperling?
I think no. I think, you know, if you're really going to say, look, these are the, you know, maybe expand it to 6 or 7. Maybe
they already have expanded it to 6.
Oh, okay.
Breaking Bad, Downton Abbey, Game of Thrones, House of Cards, Homeland, Mad Men. That's 6 shows.
Downton Abbey, Game of Thrones. Yeah, you're right. 1, 2, 3. Yeah. So, yeah. So maybe 7. Although, frankly, I think those are probably the good shows on top. I will say.
No, they're not. That's the whole point. The reason they don't need to expand to 10 is because they haven't nominated the 6 best shows. If they nominated 6 great shows, yeah, wow, those are all great shows. I wish there was room for even more. I'd say, okay, but. Homeland had a bad season. Mad Men had a horrible season. Downton Abbey is just a glorified soap. It's no better than Dallas or, you know, Falcon's Crest. There's a ton of great shows that they didn't nominate, and there's plenty of room on that list to get rid of the ones that are there. You know, Breaking Bad, Game of Thrones, House of Cards, okay, maybe your 3 are different than mine, but nonetheless, it's not that they're chock full of great shows. They're just nominating the wrong shows. If they made the right 6 shows, people wouldn't complain and say they need to expand the list.
Well, but I'm sure that people are saying
shows again and again.
I'm sure people are saying, where's The Walking Dead? I'm saying, where is Hell on Wheels, which I know is, you know, some people don't like. I'm saying, where is Copper? Again, I know I like those shows. They aren't necessarily Emmy worthy for drama series necessarily, but I like those shows. And
there's a thing. Everybody's got their own personal taste. You can say, well, I like this show. I like Archer. It's not nominated for best animated show, and yet of course, Bob's Burgers and Kung Fu Panda is.
What?
As well as the regular shows, South Park and The Simpsons. But they ignore Archer year after year. But it's not about like what I like or you like. When you talk about Emmy scandals, it should be about something like The Walking Dead. It's a massive pop cultural phenomenon, and it has great reviews. It's not just you like it. It's that everybody likes it. It gets great reviews. This is a show that should be absolutely Emmy nominated. But it's a horror film, so it doesn't get on there. Buffy the Vampire Slayer, one of the best reviewed shows of all time, never nominated for an Emmy. That's when it's a scandal. You may like Hell on Wheels. Not a lot of people do. The other one, that's got a little better reviews. What was the second one you said?
Copper.
Oh, Copper. That got some good reviews, and there will be a BBC America show soon enough. The big scandal, as far as some other reviewers were commenting, was Orphan.
Yeah.
What? Orphan Black? Is that what it's called?
Yeah.
That's on the Sci-Fi channel. Oh, that's BBC America, too. Right. They said, oh, the lead actress in that, she got robbed. She should have been nominated for Best Actress. It was a scandal that she wasn't nominated. The best performance of the year. Well, I didn't find a lot of heat for that show, but it had support. It had people watching it. And, you know, hey. So, again, the point is not that, you know, I love this show and therefore it should be on the list. It's when there's a show that has a lot of critical mass, a lot of attention. It's not like it's slipping under the radar and they just missed it. It deserves to be acknowledged. It looks bad when it's not. And that's not the case with something like Hell on Wheels. But Walking Dead just makes it look embarrassing.
Rectify.
Rectify, again, this is a show that I really liked. 6-episode series, well worth watching. It's on DVD, some of the best performances of the year. But this is on the Sundance Channel. It didn't get a ton of attention. It wasn't like everybody's talking about Rectify. I'm not shocked or upset that it didn't get a drama nomination. It would have been great if it did. The lead actor certainly deserved it, and a few other supporting people. But again, this is not a show that has built up so much momentum that it seems outrageous that it didn't. Justified was just on the edge last year. You know, it's got a fair number of writing nods and an acting win and other stuff. You felt like this show was going to break through. Did it break through this year like I predicted it might? No, it did not. And perhaps that's a reflection of the show's quality this year. It sort of lost a little bit of its mojo, just like Homeland did, and certainly Mad Men, which had a disastrous season and still got nominated for Best Drama. So do they need to expand to 10? No, because they're not even picking the right 6 now. They'll just have 10 shows that don't deserve to be on the list. What's good about that?
Top of the Lake?
Yo, I hated Top of the Lake.
Okay.
But again, it got good reviews, so it could have been nominated. But that would be for miniseries, I believe, not for drama.
The Americans?
Right, The Americans, that's another show where, look, if they wanted to be hip and young, it got very good reviews, a lot of attention. I didn't watch the whole season, so I can't speak to its quality, but it certainly is a show that was eligible and a potential on that list for best drama. That's one of the ones that probably should have been on there, taking off some of these shows that are tired and old like Mad Men and Downton Abbey. I mean, Downton Abbey is a phenomenon. It's not an outrage that it's on there, but frankly, it's just a fun show at best.
Sons of Anarchy?
Right, that's a show. It's about bikers. Never got nominated. So that's a show like Buffy where the it's long over. Besides, time has passed. It should have been nominated 4 seasons ago. It's now at the tail end of its run, like Breaking Bad is, but Breaking Bad has still maintained its quality. I'm sure it will be nominated for its final 8 episodes when they air later this year. So that show will again be up there next year, and that's probably when they'll say goodbye to it and give it perhaps its first win as best drama. You could see like something
no,
like
I don't think so, because and here's why. Uh-huh. And if you're talking about Sons of Anarchy,
I was talking about Breaking Bad.
Oh, okay, never mind.
No, Sons of Anarchy is never going to get nominated.
No, because the creator of the creator of that show has pissed off the Emmy voters.
Oh, whatever.
Yeah.
But Breaking Bad will get some love as it walks out the door, and it may be potentially a show that will win Best Drama in its final season. That doesn't look like the case for Dexter. It's sort of fallen off the list as it heads into its final season. The Office wrapped up the show. Nobody gave a damn because it hasn't been funny in years. They were like, don't let the door hit you on your way out, Office.
Right. Thanks for the $2 billion. Bye.
Well, hardly. It's not that big a hit. But 30 Rock, that was a show that, is still up there. It's nominated for Best Comedy. Maybe has a shot of winning. I don't know. It is its final season. So 30 Rock is on there on the Best Comedy list, along with The Big Bang Theory, God help us. Why would you need to have 10 slots for comedy when one of them is taken up by The Big Bang Theory? And then there's Girls, Louie, Modern Family, which everyone seemed to agree had fallen off the map this year creatively, and Veep. Again, you've got 2 shows at least there that should be off that list. Big Bang and Modern Family. I would argue 30 Rock, but I understand I'm in the minority.
I can't believe Whitney didn't get nominated.
Ha ha ha. So miniseries or movie, you've got,
Suburgatory. Suburgatory is good.
Uh-huh.
That didn't get nominated.
Well, again, that's not a scandal. That's not an outrage. It's not that it was a horrific oversight. It's a fine little show. It could have been nominated. I think if there was a traditional sitcom that would be nominated, it would be The Middle. I think that's the one that is sort of there. It's sort of in that. It's not a great show, but it's got that sort of traditional sitcom feel to it and some very good actors, especially the kids, where I feel like if you were going to go the old traditional sitcom route, that might have broken through. But this isn't the era for traditional sitcoms anymore. You've only got Big Bang Theory. That's the only one. Everything else is, 30 Rock is, I suppose, a traditional sitcom. It doesn't feel like it, though, does it?
No, it feels well.
Certainly not shot in front of an audience in a little room with 3 cameras. That's for sure.
It's a 1 camera. Yeah. What about Raising Hope?
Well, that's, again, another show that might have broken through. Again, it was probably stronger its first and second season, but a lot of good actors. And yeah, we could list a lot of shows that are good. Is it a scandal and outrage that Raising Hope wasn't nominated? It kind of was last year, first or second year. Maybe now it's gotten a little long in the tooth, but, they just stuck in their ways. That's the story of the Emmys. It always has been. It always will be. With all those good shows that weren't nominated, you have to say what comes off the list. I would say The Big Bang Theory and Modern Family on the comedy series route.
Yeah, because, and Mad Men, frankly.
That's drama.
Okay.
I've said that 4 times already. They should get rid of Mad Men. I haven't liked the show since season one, but last year was ridiculously bad. And frankly, everybody finally woke up and said, it may not be its best season. You think?
Right.
It was a nightmare creatively. But anyway, those are the biggest head scratchers, I think. Some things I don't understand. You know, there's a couple little quirks in the Emmy nominations. Tell me, Sperling, what is the category special visual effects in a supporting role? What the heck could that mean?
Puppets. They're talking about
yeah,
puppets.
That's a good answer.
I have no idea
what that is. I couldn't figure it out even looking at the shows that were not.
I bet you, and I'm shooting from the hip here, but I bet you when you're talking about zombies and all these people covered in makeup and that are kind of
that seems too hard to quantify though.
Yeah, that's true.
But maybe that's what it is. It's not a special effects driven show, but they did special effects and kept them invisible. Maybe, you know, like a historical epic or something. Maybe that's what it means. I don't know.
And really, Al Pacino for Phil Spector, that movie was horrible.
I didn't see it, but he got some good reviews, didn't he?
Yeah.
He's a movie star.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly why they have him there. Now, Michael Douglas and Matt Damon behind the candelabra.
Uh-huh.
They're up against one another. They should both win.
But HBO, my God, that movie drew like a couple million people, and yet it's being treated like it's a big blockbuster event. You know, more power to HBO. They know what they're doing. The Bible, of course, was the highest rated of all of these, but it was pretty bad. But it did get, you know, at least the nominal nomination for Best Miniseries.
Oh, and Top of the Lake did get nominated, so I take that back.
Yes, there it is, along with American Horror Story, which was the one show to receive the most nominations of any single programming event.
I cannot believe that Big Brother and The Biggest Loser and Celebrity Apprentice did not get nominated in reality competition series. Unbelievable. They were robbed.
Yes, nobody really cares about the reality competition series. And of course, American Idol is off the list again. That show has really faded by the wayside. Very sad to see. The Voice is on there. Amazing Race. Dances with the Stars. So You Think You Can Dance. Seems to be the same shows every year because it's the same shows every year. Same thing in late night. The biggest news in late night is, yet again, the people that are missing. Look who's missing from late night. Letterman, Leno, Conan, Ferguson. They're nowhere to be seen. Their era has passed. Does David Letterman know that? Has anyone told him? He'd get even crankier.
That's true.
Oh,
although
my God.
He's kind of been a little bit less cranky lately.
Yeah, a couple of heart attacks tends to mellow you out.
Oh, man. That is true.
So it's hard to get excited about the Emmys when you know what shows are going to be nominated every year and what's going to win. You know, who knows? I mean, Mad Men is gunning for like yet another one in a row, or, you know, it just gets exhausting.
Right. So you could care less.
Yes. I'd say it's a big, I wouldn't say it's a big whoop, but it's a big scandal. I guess it is a big whoop. The same old shows got nominated.
Yes. I'm glad you took the bait there because I was trying to head you into Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense.
Bring it on.
Our first story. It just goes to show you that anything is possible, especially when there's money to be made. That's the lesson to be learned from the announcement that Keith Olbermann is returning to ESPN, or more accurately, ESPN2. Olbermann made headlines when he had dinner with the head of ESPN, who demurely said they were just catching up on his contract. Now, of course, the real reason comes out. Olbermann is returning to the network that made him famous. He'll host a late-night show on ESPN2 starting in the fall, though the format and style, could it be Charlie Rose, maybe Nightline, well, that's yet to be determined. Nightline might not be such a crazy stretch, since Olbermann will be filming the show in the Nightline studio that overlooks Times Square, and these days, sports is ripe for a more timely discussion of the big issues of the day, along with, you know, taped investigative pieces on, say, you know,
Alex Rodriguez,
performance-enhancing drugs, drug doping, blood doping, performance-enhancing drugs. Yeah, all those types of things. And, of course, they could weigh in on controversial issues, which is what Olbermann does best. Guess who's joining him at ESPN and the Disney family? Guess who? You'll never guess in a million years.
Nate Silver of the 538 blog.
Oh, okay, maybe you will guess then. Yes, Nate Silver, the guy who called the last political election except for one campaign.
A Senate race or something?
Yeah,
I think.
In the He's leaving the New York Times because he's crazy. No. And while he's leaving the New York Times and is expected to have a wide-ranging portfolio in his new job at ESPN, including a role on Olbermann's sports show, as well as some work for ABC News during the election season, and even more. So is all of this Keith Olbermann, Nate Silver News, a big deal or a big whoop?
That's a big deal. I'm more freaked out by Nate Silver than I am Keith Olbermann. It makes sense for Keith. It makes sense for ESPN. There's no reason not to bring him back. I think it could be a show like Nightland. That might be a smart thing, or an interview show. It's certainly not going to be a SportsCenter type show. He's on ESPN too, they say, because they got to keep rerunning SportsCenter. That's their premium cash cow. But of course, if he hits big ratings, guess what? I bet he'll be over on the mothership pretty soon. But keep Nate Silver. Nate Silver, a lot of people said, brought more to the Times than the Times brought to him. And a lot, some of it came with headaches. So he brings his audience with him. Wherever he goes, he'll be a success. It's not just ESPN he's going to, though he loves sports and he wants to talk about it. Though, you know, he has a spotty track record in basketball and March Madness and the Oscars. So when he strays away from politics, he's not the perfect savant that he's been in that venue. However, as he says, he hasn't done a lot of work in those areas, so he has to refine his models and focus on it a lot more. Then he'll be able to do a better job. When it's not like a little hobby on the side, like March Madness was, well, then he'll be able to perhaps do a better job and bring his analytical skills to weigh in on sports and entertainment, just like he does with politics. But it's an interesting mix. I guess the lure of TV was too much. Could the New York Times offer him anything like ESPN and the Disney people did? No.
No, and actually that was, when you look at the readership of the New York Times, it's huge. I'm not taking away, but it's the 49th most popular website on the internet, at least in North America.
Well, it usually gets higher ratings, more viewers per month than ESPN does.
No, it does not.
Well, but ESPN gets like an average in prime time, like, what, 8 million?
I'm talking about website, 26th most popular website.
Oh, web traffic.
Yeah.
So it's the 39th versus the 26th, whatever.
49th
versus the 26th. So they're both huge.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, it's like you're arguing over spoils at this point.
But ESPN is not his home, I don't think. I don't think he's going to be ESPN 99% of the time. I thought it was sort of misleading the way that story was sold. He goes to ESPN. Oh, and ABC News and the Disney family. And, you know, I think, and the 538 blog is separate from all of that. So he has his 538 blog, whether it's hosted by ESPN or not, he can talk about whatever he wants. And that's where his audience finds him.
Well, our next story is about Woody Allen. And in the court showdown between Woody Allen and William Faulkner, Silly Trump Serious and the lawsuit brought by the Faulkner estate against Sony Pictures and the movie Midnight in Paris has collapsed. In the movie about a time-traveling screenwriter, Owen Wilson, who plays the main character, he said, "The past is not dead. Actually, it's not even past. You know who said that? Faulkner. And he was right. And I met him, too. I ran into him at a dinner party. Ka-chow." And maybe he didn't say that last little word there, but, you know, he did in another movie. In any
Keep
case,
going.
In the little-known novel Requiem for a Nun, Faulkner wrote, "The past is never dead. It's not even past." The judge ruled quite reasonably that the character is paraphrasing a 9-word quote, and while the quote is well-known, no one would possibly imagine that referencing Faulkner implied that the movie was endorsed by the Faulkner estate, nor did it damage the commercial viability of the novel, which nobody knew about, in my opinion. If anything, it surely helped bring attention to the book. I agree. Given the different mediums, intentions, and the very brief nature of the quote, the judge ruled it was indeed fair use. I wish I had my like some sound effect, maybe like reverb. Fair use. No?
Okay. Keep going.
The estate might still be able to sue in state court on other grounds, but for now, the lawsuit has proven a lot of sound and fury signifying nothing. Get it?
Yep.
Okay,
yep.
Just checking. Maybe I needed that reverb effect signifying nothing. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal. It's good to have fair use upheld. It seemed a very silly lawsuit. I mean, you know, what if someone says you can't go home again? And then they even attributed Faulkner, for God's sake. It just seemed crazy. So I'm glad that they lost.
Okay. Well, let's talk about the NCAA, because there has been a very interesting development in the world of video games. The National Collegiate Athletic Association, here in North America, the NCAA, announced it would not be renewing its licensing deal with Electronic Arts, one of the leading video game companies and the makers of the NCAA football video game. That means the 2014 edition will be the last one for now with the NCAA logo and the name and stamp of approval. Why? Are they branching out on their own? Getting out of video games altogether because the hassle of being sued by former college players isn't worth the money, possibly? Who knows? The NCAA acknowledged that litigation, they said, yes, we are being sued, but also insisted it had never licensed the names or images of any particular player. It just so happens that all those video game players look like the guys on the field. Does this open the door to regional deals like an SEC college football game? And will video gamers even care, especially video gamers from overseas, where NCAA stands for just four letters? Big deal or big what, Michael?
I imagine overseas gamers are not big players of college football video games.
I would agree.
I mean, that's not their audience. But anyway, thanks to Aaron Rich for sending the story our way. It's kind of fascinating. A lot of different developments around it. First of all, the NCAA can't block individual schools from making a deal. So if Notre Dame wants to sign a licensing deal with some video game maker, they can. So will the SEC. So will the Pac, you know, the Big Ten, the Pac-12. You know, who knows all the ramifications of what might happen. But it doesn't stop just because the NCAA decides not to do it. But there's money to be made, but there's also money to be sued on. So, you know, whether it'll be worth the hassle until this all gets cleared up as far as who has the right to do this. You know, it's all part of the fact that football is a huge multi-billion dollar business, but most schools lose money and the players lose most of all.
Well, so what you're saying is that when lawsuits come around, the lawyers follow the money.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Somebody told me that once. I should
and
follow
let's follow up a story that we talked about on 2 weeks ago, I think.
Yes, it was 2 weeks ago. And it was about Jennifer Lopez, because we want to know whether celebrities will soon discover that it just doesn't pay to get a sleazy million-dollar check from dictators and corrupt businessmen when it can damage your brand and make you look cheap. Jennifer Lopez was denounced by Amnesty International for performing at the birthday party of the dictator of Turkmenistan, the head of one of the most repressive regimes in the world. But what's a little human rights abuse when you can collect seven figures for singing a few songs and shaking your bum? Lopez's people dismissed it as a last-minute gig and no big deal. Now Amnesty International is detailing her repeated availability for a paycheck. She shows up for birthday parties and croons happy birthday for corrupt businessmen and was booked by the dictatorship of Azerbaijan to perform at a soccer event. While there, she met with the dictator's wife to plan a music festival tied in with CAA, my old stomping grounds, creative artists agency. She went to Belarus, the last dictatorship in Europe, on her world tour because, you know,
you wouldn't want to miss that.
Yeah, if you're doing like a human rights world tour, you definitely got to visit Belarus. The total money for these gigs hit eight figures, but will it hit her bottom line if people decide she's tarnished? Well, are you trying to say, will it tarnish her bum? I don't know. Will other celebs decide it's not worth the money to get branded as the sort who would have played Sun City during apartheid in South Africa? The New York Post certainly had fun with it. They put Lopez on the cover with a big headline saying, five tyrants, 2 years, $9 million. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
So far, it's a big whoop. I mean, the fact that the Post put her on the cover, that's a big deal. That ratchets up the pressure and the attention. Clearly, it was a slow news day or they wouldn't have bothered, but I think it's great. You know, it brings attention to it. She should be embarrassed. She should be ashamed. And when I was looking at that cover, what did I hear on TV? I saw a Verizon ad because she's the spokesperson for Viva Mobile, I should say, which is a Verizon service targeted to the Latino and Hispanic population. She's their spokesperson. Do they want to be associated with a spokesperson who's involved with countries and, you know, dictators and corrupt businessmen? I don't think so. Is that cool for her? Is that cool for them? No, it's not. So if she pays a price, it may set a precedent. If she gets embarrassed, gives back money, donates it to charity, vows never to do it again, stops making lame excuses like who knew that, you know, that Turkmenistan was not a font of human rights. You know, if she gives all that up and pays a price and learns a lesson and does better down the road, maybe that will keep other celebrities from doing the same thing. And that's what really matters.
Well, and, you know, you mentioned that you saw her on a Verizon commercial. Over the weekend, I saw her on, I think, a Kohl's commercial, a clothing...
Oh, she's got lots of sponsors, of course.
Yeah, three different commercials.
She starts to become an embarrassing figure for them to be associated with. If people start calling Verizon saying, why are you paying a woman who gets paid by dictators and, you know, and thugs? Then they don't like that. They don't need that. They want someone that's free and easy. Excuse me. They want someone who's...
Wow.
You know, got a nice image that brings positive stuff to their campaign, not someone that creates headaches. And that's what she could be doing right now if people keep up the pressure. Should I care? Of course. I think I should care. I think it's embarrassing when they do this. I as a celebrity, she's worth all that money. She wants to get a paycheck. She's going to go to a dictatorship. It's just bizarre to me. I can't imagine why you'd ever want to bother. It just seems so sleazy. If you're at the end of your career and you had no choice, I could see it. But when you're at the height of your fame, you know, it's just—it just boggles my mind.
Summertime is proving a great time for the networks. First, CBS scored one of the biggest drama hits of the year with Under the Dome. Now the CW is enjoying its biggest hit since The Arrow. What's the show? A revival of the improv comedy show Whose Line Is It Anyway, hosted by Aisha Tyler. It began in the UK, came to ABC with Drew Carey on board, and worked as a journeyman filler on the network's schedule. But its summer debut on the CW exploded, at least by that channel standards, with 3 million viewers. The best showing for the Tuesday 8 p.m. time slot in 5 years for that network. Big deal or big whoop.
Aisha Tyler, by the way, a voice actor on Archer. I should point that out.
Ah, okay.
So good for her. I'm glad she's got another. I think it's a big deal. They got a program shows in summer. It's a proven franchise. It's not a great show or anything, but it's fun, silly nonsense. I liked the original British one, so I shouldn't turn my nose up at it. But hey, you put on good quality programming, you're going to reach an audience, and it's an important lesson for them to learn. You can't do it on the cheap. You can't just take retreads of bad shows that you would never want to show anyway. You've got to try and put on programming you think people want to watch. Oh, it's a boy. By the way, the Duchess of Cambridge just gave birth. It's a boy. We heard it first while we're on the podcast. But of course, people will be hearing that days after it's all old news. But it just happened just now.
Right. Well, maybe
I've just proven I'm a British subject.
Right. Should we also mention that Dennis Farina passed away?
Well, what a lovely pairing. There's a death and there's a birth. The cycle of life. Is that what you're doing? Yes. I mean, I don't like the show to become an obit column. But yes, an actor died. Very sad. Dennis Farina. Between Dennis Farina and who was the other grizzled vet that died recently?
I have no idea who you're referring to.
You know, it was...
No, I don't.
Yeah. Oh, James Gandolfini.
Oh, yes.
Right.
Okay.
Gandolfini and Dennis Farina. Dennis Franz must be hiding in his apartment right now.
There,
now I've just made light of death. You know, he's a fine actor. He was in some good shows. Crime Story was a good show. You know, and he segued out into comedy. You know, it's he was 69 years old. Very sad, but there you go.
Well, this next story I love because this sounds like a joke, but director Terrence Malick is being sued by investors for making, get this, too many movies. That's right. The man who famously indifferent to Hollywood, and he took 5 years to make his second movie and then 20 years to make his third, is now making so many movies he can't keep his project straight. At least that's the claim of an investment group that pitched in $3.3 million for a proposed documentary, a film project called Voyage of Time. Since Malick's eye for nature is, of course, everybody knows it's famed, he's got a great eye, it might seem obvious to let him tackle a documentary film about the history of the universe. It was intended to include two 45-minute IMAX films, which were probably meant for long-running stints at natural history museums around the world, and a theatrical version anywhere from 90 minutes to 2.5 hours long. Now, given that it's Malick, I'm going to go with the 2.5 hours long version. But since they ponied up the money, it's not that Malick has been dragging his heels. In fact, he's made or in post-production on 4 different movies. That's right, 4 different movies, including Tree of Life, To the Wonder, and 2 films yet to be released, both starring Christian Bale and Natalie Portman. When Malick asked for more money from this investment group, they asked for an accounting and are now suing for their money and lost profits. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop, I imagine. It'll get resolved before they go to trial. I love that they're suing for lost profits. Have you seen the lines on Tree of Life in these last 4 or 5 movies? Because profits is not exactly what you make when you invest in a Malick film. So it's a nice dream that they would actually make a profit on it, but it does sound sort of crazy, though. Terrence Malick, the man who could never make a movie, made 4 movies in the midst of trying to make this other movie. It's just it's bizarre turn of events.
I think it would be funny if the judge says, you know, investment group, you're absolutely right. Now you owe Terrence Malick $4 million because that's how much money he would have lost you.
Exactly.
Okay, this next story is about...
The lad weighs over 8 pounds, by the way. I just want you to know that. The news is trickling in on the new heir who will be the heir to the throne someday. But anyway.
Okay, well, thank you very much for that. Let's talk about another lad. The sitcom 2.5 Men, make it that 2 men. Yes, Angus T. Jones, there's the lad in question. The young star who trashed his own sitcom as morally offensive is being cut from the opening credits of the show.
Oh.
Is it because the actor is headed off to college and will only be appearing in a handful of episodes? Or is it because he publicly lambasted the show and said it was shameful to work on it? More importantly, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's the definition of a big whoop.
Okay, well, I would agree. This, though, I wonder if this is a big deal or a big whoop, because is Netflix cropping the movies it streams online?
What?
A Tumblr account called What Netflix Does purported to show numerous examples of how Netflix crops the movies it shows. One example showed the Jim Carrey movie Man on the Moon, in which one actor was cropped out of the scene altogether, was kind of off screen.
That's what cropping does.
Yes. That account had been up for a while and suddenly got some attention, by which the LA Times probably meant they spotted it. But Netflix said they never crop films. Sometimes, however, the suppliers send them a cropped film and they don't catch the mistake. When they do, they correct it if they can. Further, the Tumblr account showing the terrible cropping had just 13 examples, and 8 of them weren't movies that Netflix can even stream. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Is Netflix cropping movies? No. Therefore, the answer is big whoop.
Yeah.
Here's what I don't get. First of all, I thought it was amazing that you said, well, the LA Times said it got attention, which means they spotted it, which is probably true. Oh, look at that. Oh, it's getting attention.
You know what? You know? In the Times' defense, a lot of people finally spotted it, so it wasn't just the Times.
Well, who's the lot of people? Did a lot of people write a story about this? No.
Yes.
Who else?
We have a column here from Vulture. This is a story from Vulture, New York Magazine.
They linked to the LA Times story, right?
No, they linked directly to the Tumblr blog.
So why didn't you link to the LA Times story?
I don't know where you're getting the LA Times from.
Flavor Wire ran a post. Flavor Wire and Vulture. Okay, that's everybody. Well, why does it say the LA Times on it?
I don't know.
Venture Beat, whoever that is.
Oh my gosh, please don't say that. Venture Beat is a huge site.
Never heard of it. I'm not an online geek like you. I don't go to Flavor Wire. I never go to Vulture. I've never heard of Venture Beat. Never heard of it.
You must have a lot of time on your hands then, because
yes, because I don't waste my time online with 8 million sites. Anyway, I don't know why you say the LA Times, because they're not anywhere on this link. Are you sure they did a story?
I'm not sure at all. I don't know why the LA Times was put into this piece. You know what? Let's just move on.
Oh, wait. I wrote it.
See?
It's my fault. You linked to it, and I wrote it. I don't know how I got it. Came up with the LA Times.
I wasn't going to point that out, but thank you very much.
Well, leave it in since I'm the fool. So it was a Vulture story that linked to a story in Flavor Wire. Venture Beat, which I've never heard of, called up Netflix and said, what's going on? And Netflix said, no, sometimes they just give us the wrong copy. Here's my question. One, why is this a story? Like, it all began because of a Tumblr account with 13 examples, 8 of which are fake.
Well, they're not fake.
They are fake because Netflix wasn't cropping those 8 movies because they don't even show them.
Well,
and it wasn't that they went out of cycle. It's that they're not movies that get shown in America. So they only had 5 examples of movies that were cropped. Secondly, why would anybody send, who crops movies anymore?
I don't know.
Who would spend the time to crop a movie?
Whoever's doing the mastering.
But why? For what purpose?
Well, I think sometimes what happens is it gets cropped by whoever the mastering house, and nobody notices it.
Why? No, why? No. No, we're talking about prints made for TV or something else. They used to crop everything for VHS and television. Today, they don't crop movies on TV. They don't crop movies for VHS because VHS doesn't exist. You don't find cropped versions on your DVDs anymore. You used to have both offers. You want the actual movie and the letterbox and the crop? They would offer both. That doesn't happen anymore.
Yes, but when you're doing a cheap release and you go back to the master that you did for VHS, which does...
Well, there is no VHS anymore.
No, yes, but the master still exists. And you say, well, let's not remaster this.
We're talking about movies from the past.
Yes.
So we're not talking about new movies.
Because
nobody would crop a new movie, right?
No.
Or
would
they do it for an airline, maybe?
Yes.
Those tiny little screens, maybe they crop them for that?
Correct. That is the only reason you would do it. And they actually state that now on such movies. They say this film has been modified in the following ways.
Well,
it's been modified
for a while, but the only reason you can think of for that happening today for a new movie is because they're making a version for airlines.
Correct. Or, some version of it where they have no choice because the screens are going to be a certain size.
And that's about it. So what happens is perhaps Netflix got sent the airline version by accident.
Or some version that from an old master. Yes, correct.
Well, if it's a really old movie. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, there you go. It sounds like a big whoop to me. They've got quality control. They got a million movies. And every once in a while, they get sent the wrong print. Okay.
Yes. Well, that wraps up big deal or big whoop for this week and moves us right.
A lot of whoops this week.
Now it's time for Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. Now, do you remember, Michael, how I made mention that we should keep in our minds, in the back of our minds, that whole concept of catalogs from big companies and newer artists?
I do.
Well, that's really what this week's story is about. It's about
Spotify.
It's about Spotify and Thom Yorke, the lead singer and member of Radiohead, who has gone off to start his own band.
This is not a new band. He's done Atoms for Peace for a while.
Okay.
He's not launching a new band. It's a spinoff project that he's done for a while. It's nothing new.
Yeah, I felt like I saw them in Coachella a couple of years ago.
Yeah, yeah. No, nobody said it was a new band.
Although at the time it was called Thom Yorke. It was not called
Adams. He has had his Thom Yorke solo album. He's also had this side project called Atoms for Peace. They're two separate things.
Right.
And it's been around for a while.
And now he's saying, hey, I'm pulling all of my catalog, the ones that I can control, Atoms for Peace and my solo work, from Spotify because they don't pay me enough in royalties. They stream the heck out of it, but then...
No, that's not true. He's saying, pulling it symbolically because he doesn't feel they pay other people enough. It's not that he's saying, I'm not making enough money off Spotify. He's saying, this is an outrage. Young bands are suffering, and I'm going to make a symbolic protest because I have the platform and visibility to do it.
Did he say that?
Well, yes. He said it was a meaningless gesture done. It wasn't saying that I'm hurt by it. He's a millionaire. He knows that. He was doing it because he wants to make a protest for young bands who need the help, not for himself. He's doing it because other artists are suffering, the newer artists, the younger artists. He's a well-known act. He's saying new acts that are coming up that should get more money from Spotify than they are right now, and I'm going to protest to do it. He's not bitching for himself. He's trying to create attention for an issue he feels strongly about. Adams for Peace, by the way, is a super group with Flea from Red Hot Chili Peppers. It's been around since 2009.
Okay, that's when I saw them, actually.
There you go. Yeah. Several albums and singles and music videos. This is not a new band. He's not talking about himself. He's not bitching for himself. He is advocating for what he thinks is right for the industry and other acts. He is an already established superstar. He knows that. He's always pushed against the limits and constraints. He's always pushed for new models. And he's saying Spotify doesn't pay those new acts that need help. Not me, but those new acts, they need to get more money from Spotify.
Well, now, a couple points. You mentioned that he has always advocated. In 2007, he released In Rainbows. Well, Radiohead released In Rainbows. And it was like a pay what you want release.
That's right. He said, pay me what you want. And it worked great.
Yeah,
but it was
a
bold experiment. You know, it was a great album, too. One of their best albums in a while. And it worked well for everybody.
Yeah. And, of course, he also teamed up this week with, I can't remember the name of the service, but basically it will push out all of the live video of all the shows after they're over.
Uh-huh. So basically he's saying, look, Spotify's broken. Their business model is unfair to young musicians and to newer acts. Even if you succeed and get a lot of views, you still make pittance in dollars. And he's saying it can't last. What did Spotify say?
Well, Spotify came along and they said, I'm trying to find out where it says Spotify's goal is to grow a service which people love, ultimately want to pay for, and which will provide the financial support to the music industry necessary to invest in new talent and music. We want to help artists connect with their fans, find new audiences, grow their fan base, and make a living from the music we all love. Right now, we're still in the early stages of a long-term project that's already having a hugely positive effect on artists and new music. We've already paid $500 million to rights holders so far, and by the end of 2013, this number will reach $1 billion. Much of this money is being invested in nurturing new talent and producing great new music.
All right, let's not read the whole thing. Yeah, so $500 million divided up by 500 million artists, or how many artists? Right, we've already done stories before where even acts who've had like a million plays on Spotify get a check for a few thousand dollars.
Or like a dollar, yeah.
So the point is not how much money have they given out total, but how much money have people gotten on the tail end when they have a hit on Spotify? And the answer is not very much. Unless you're an absolute massive act, you're not making a lot of money on Spotify.
That's right.
They want to say, oh, we're launching a new business. We need your help. You have to give us a cut. We want to build our business on your music, and you need to give it to us for free or really cheaply so we can do that. And they're saying, well, if you can't make your business without paying us a good amount of money, we don't care. We don't care if you have a business, if it means we don't make money and people get our music for free. That doesn't help us.
Well, and Nigel Godrich, who is also in Atoms for Peace and produces Radiohead, he's effectively saying, look, the system is rigged in a way because these big giant catalogs, these big labels with giant catalogs, they get a bigger chunk of that $500 million, whereas small labels who might have new acts, they're struggling. They're the ones that are struggling because their royalty rates aren't the same.
Uh-huh. Well, that's the way of the world, isn't it? I mean, a bigger label has more power to get a better royalty rate. You need a decent royalty rate for everyone. I mean, the argument that small acts should get more money because they're small and not well-known is silly. Of course, they don't make a lot of money from radio. Right. They don't make a lot of money from publishing. They don't make a lot of money because they're a small act nobody's heard of yet. But the point is, even if you hit it, even if you have a lot of success on Spotify, you still don't make a lot of money. So that's where the problem is, to my mind.
Well, the reason I pulled this story up is because, well, a couple of reasons. One, the whole argument was had in the press between all these different media outlets, and of course it started on Twitter, but then immediately moved to, you know, Hypebot and Pitchfork, and so effectively Nigel Godrich and Tom York were talking through the media, as was Spotify. So that was number one. And number two, I found it funny that Radiohead's own co-manager, Brian Message, kind of said, look, I think Spotify's pretty good, actually. I think it's good for musicians. Now, I don't disagree with Tom. You know, we're having this debate. It's an ongoing debate. And it's good that we're raising these issues.
I think it's the oldest story in the book. Every time there's a new medium, television, compact discs, DVDs, VHS, the big studio says, oh, we're investing a lot of money. We don't know if it's going to work. You got to give us much lower rates. Ebooks, same things. The publishers wanted to pay less money to authors for a sale in an ebook. Oh, no, it's a new medium. We don't know what's going to happen. You got to give us a big deal. You got to cut your royalty rate. You got to cut what we're paying you. We can't do it. We're trying to launch this new business here. And then it launches and it makes tons of money, and you got to fight and claw back to get to where you were before the whole business launched. If Spotify can't work without paying artists enough money that makes it worth their while to be on it, then they deserve to go under. Period. And you should not cut them any deals. Don't give them a cut rate because they're a nice new kid. They just raised a couple $100 million with capitalization, right?
Yes.
You know, they don't need any handouts. They've got plenty of money. If they can't do it and pay you enough money to make it worth your while to be on their service, then get off of it. Because if you're getting like a million plays and you're still getting pennies, you're a chump. Right, you're a chump helping them build a huge business, and you're never going to make any money, and it's not worth your publicity to be on there. It's just not.
And of course, a lot of outlets were beginning.
If people want to get your music for free, they can steal it. That's what I say. Why let Spotify make billions of dollars off of it? Let them steal it the old-fashioned way.
Showbiz Sandbox does not condone piracy.
I don't, but you know, fans can get the music for free already. I don't know why Spotify should.
Well, some media outlets pointed out that, you know, there's a comparison here for subscription models for content, and that is cable. Cable, you know, you pay a one set fee, and you can watch as much television as you want, and then your money...
Unless you want to watch HBO, in which you pay more.
Correct. And I think, you know, maybe Spotify...
Or unless I have the YES Network, which carries the Yankee games. If I want to watch it on their online version, I have to pay an extra $30. Give me a break.
Yeah, like, that's ridiculous.
It shouldn't just be a service they provide. It's very annoying.
Well, maybe Spotify needs to charge more. Maybe that's part of the issue here, is that, yes, it works in television, but we're also paying $50 a month. So
$50? You pay $50?
Well, just for the cable portion, not the cable internet portion.
Well, $50 is an awfully low thing for just cable only, I would think. Well, digital cable with a DVR and
I don't use the DVR. I use TiVo.
Oh, well, there you go. So, well, the DVR is like an extra $3 a month, but anyway.
Yeah. Well, that's inside baseball for this week, and that actually...
So what did we learn? What did we learn?
What did we learn?
Spotify doesn't want to pay money. Tom York brought attention to an issue we've already talked about. Have we learned anything new?
No, not really. I don't know.
Oh, well, maybe I shouldn't have pointed that out.
Yeah, I don't know. I think basically you have big name acts like Tom York and Radiohead. They're beginning to take notice of this, whereas Pink Floyd, on the other hand, is giving their catalog to Spotify. They cut their own deal with Spotify.
What? They did. They had their big letter in USA Today where they were denouncing them.
Oh, maybe I'm wrong. Let me see.
We talked about that 2 weeks ago.
I thought that they liked them. Was I wrong? Am I getting this all mixed up?
You're getting it all mixed up. Pink Floyd wrote the editorial in USA Today, Roger Waters and David Gilmour and the other guy, and Nick Mason, and talked about how it was ridiculous, how Spotify doesn't want to pay for music. And he said it's like having a grocery store that bitches they don't want to have to pay for the food that they sell. You're like, oh, we have to pay all this money for food? Well, of course that's your biggest expense. That's what you do. You sell food. Spotify's like, well, you have to pay all this money for music. We'll never be profitable. Well, tough. That's Pink Floyd.
According to, okay, well.
They just had an editorial in USA Today 2 weeks ago. If you listen to Showbiz Sandbox, you would know that.
Wait a minute. This can't be right because, okay, it says here, USA Today, since you brought up USA Today, royalty disputes strike sour note in streaming music. Last month, classic rockers Pink Floyd criticized Pandora, Spotify.
All right, whatever. Okay.
So they basically, you know, gave their music to Spotify and stuck their tongue out at Pandora. I think you need to listen more closely.
Well, but they did it for a price that they were happy with, obviously. They didn't give it away for free.
True.
Right. I mean, you're saying they're not allowed to charge the...
No,
The point is not to not make a deal with Spotify. The point is to make enough money so you feel it's worth your while. If Pink Floyd thought Pandora was not paying enough, but Pandora was trying to change the laws in Congress to give them a cut rate deal.
That's ridiculous.
And they got enough money from Spotify that it was worth their time to be on there. And they did. They held out from, you know, iTunes for a long time, just like Led Zeppelin did. I mean, these acts who make big money, they're no fools. They're making their money. That's not hypocritical or wrong.
Right, but I'm going back to the part where you said I was wrong for saying that Pink Floyd is on Spotify. Well,
you were wrong for saying that they somehow have betrayed themselves and gave it away for free.
That's less important than me being right about... Yeah, anyway. You know, if you want to write to us and tell us how wrong we were or how correct we were, you could. You could email us, nobody's going to email us?
No one's going to say how correct we are.
Oh, that last part, yes. But if you do want to tell us how wrong we were...
The worst inside baseball ever.
dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can subscribe to the show, and we urge you to subscribe to the show on iTunes or on Stitcher or any podcast aggregator. You can even rate and review the shows there. Links to all the stories we discussed on today's show can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you'll find ways to follow us. And you can follow us on Twitter, where our username is @showbizsandbox. Or you can follow us or like us on Facebook. Again, look up Showbiz Sandbox. We have a page there that you can like. Again, all of that information on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has, well, so many websites now. He's like an internet mogul. You can find some of his writing and some of his work on michaelgiltz.com, but where else can we find you, Michael?
It'saboy.com.
It'saboy.com. Well, you might want to check out bookfilter.com, where there might be a book or two that he recommends about the royal couple or the royal baby or whatever they're going to call it now. Some of my writing can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until not next week, but 2 weeks from now, play nice.